Offshore millions of American jobs, roll back Wall Street reforms, sneak in SOPA-like threats to Internet freedom, ban Buy American policies needed to create green jobs, jack up the costs of medicines, expose the United States to unsafe food and products, and empower corporations to attack our environmental and health safeguards. Although it is called a free trade agreement, the TPP is not mainly about trade. Of TPP's 29 draft chapters, only 5 deal with traditional trade issues. One chapter would provide incentives to offshore jobs to low-wage countries. Many would impose limits on government policies that we rely on in our daily lives for safe food, a clean environment, and more. Our domestic, federal, state, and local policies would be required to comply with TPP rules. The TPP would even elevate individual foreign firms to equal status with sovereign nations, empowering them to privately enforce new rights and privileges provided by the pact, by dragging governments to foreign tribunals to demand taxpayer compensation over policies that they claim undermined their expected future profits. The following is an excerpt from a recent conversation I had with Frank Neff of MoveOn.org, whose long experience with trade agreements gives him special insight into the TPP. The Congress has petitioned, on a couple of occasions anyway, that the White House release some information about this agreement. And how can this move forward if our legislators have not had an opportunity to review it and to make input, and the White House has, in fact, denied access on written petitions? Where's the democracy here?
Yeah. I think that you raised one of the central questions in my mind about the operation of Fast Track and the way in which we go about making these trade agreements, and that is that these agreements have a way of affecting you and me and our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to persuade people some years ago here in the community that these agreements are not good things because they are undermining the city council here in Lenexa. Because if some guy from Middle East establishes a restaurant here and they're complaining that he doesn't meet the specified requirements, and they go to him and say, we're not going to let you come unless you do that, he is in a position to say, look, I think that we provide excellent food and safe food, and you are now arguing that my procedures are not adequate. You're going to have to prove that. I don't have to prove that they're adequate. You have to prove that they are inadequate. And so this means then that the city of Lenexa would be required to come up with proof. Presumably, they would. Now, we have to think about it as presumably, because if there is that kind of a dispute, this entrepreneur from Middle East someplace, this corporate leader, can say, you're interfering with the operation of my business, and you are interfering in ways that are not fair, that are not just. And I'm going to take you to the tribunals, and we're going to get this thing settled through the tribunals. Well, now, these tribunals are things that have been put into place because there have been disputes in international work, international trade, for a long time. The thing is that these agreements now are sort of tied to these claims that a corporate leader like this guy from the Middle East, the claims that they would make are taken to the nation, not to Lenexa. They take it to Washington, D.C. and claim that something needs to be done. And so if nothing happens, then they can bring a claim to a trade tribunal, which is associated with the trade agreement. So NAFTA has a set of people who are typically people that are in international trade, or they are particular experts in international trade in a university or something like that. For some reason, they are seen by people in the international trade as being knowledgeable about it. So they pick three One is picked by the entrepreneur who's bringing the claim. One is picked by the United States government, if the claim would be one like against Lenexa. And the third one, hopefully, the two parties, the United States government and the entrepreneur, will agree on the third one. If they don't, then there's an administrative group in NAFTA, I'm mixing up my trade agreements, but there would be an administrative group in the trade agreement that would be relevant that would pick the third party. So then the claims and counterclaims are brought to this tribunal. And those three people listen to whatever is said and look at the evidence that those people bring and make their decision. And they can about make any kind of decision they want to, because in a sense they are inventing international law.
You're listening to an interview by Linda Neville of MoveOn.org with Frank Neff discussing the multinational secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Hmm. Well, you see, if this thing gets agreed to by the tribunal, and that's the end of it, if there's no effort to do anything more, then that's the policy.
That's the finality.
And the next time a dispute like that comes along, this agreement here will be one of the things that will be taken into consideration in that dispute, because there's not other law to go to. That is a law, you know, that would be, well, they can certainly bring a claim to the tribunals on anything that is operating in the trade area, and see whether or not they can persuade the tribunal that they are right. So what this does is to essentially discount the court system in the United States. Now, it is possible for a corporate head to come into United States courts with this kind of a claim. He could bring that claim to an American court, but I think generally they prefer going to these tribunals because
it's a lot simpler.
Well, yeah, and then too, if they get into a jury in the United States, they're likely to see that the jury's biased, and it may be that the jury is somewhat biased. On this Buy American stuff, I think the jury would be kind of biased.
Very biased. Yeah. Yes, but they're biased on the other side too, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you can see that what the fast track does is enable the agreement process to be sort of separate from the legislature. Now, as I said a while back, is that the theory, as I understand it, for fast track is there's supposed to be regular interaction between Congress and the tribunal. But as you said, or not tribunal, the negotiators for the trade agreement. But as you said, they just don't get it. I mean, they won't do it. And this particular treaty and this particular administration seems to be extremely strong in trying to stay with secrecy. And, you know, something that I've thought about is, think about the typical person in business. I know limited about this, but this is my imagination about how it goes, is that a guy who supplies steel and a guy who manufactures washing machines say they think they can do business with each other. So they sit down and talk about it. And they talk about everything under the sun. And they can work out the agreement however they want to work it out. And they don't advertise what they're doing. So they tend to be secretive about it. They don't want their competition to know what kind of agreement they've made. And maybe the steel manufacturer doesn't want the rest of the washing machine business industry to know that he made a special deal for this particular manufacturer. And neither the manufacturer nor the steelmaker want anybody else to know it. So they do that in secret. And what I'm imagining is that a lot of the negotiators and the people advising them come from that kind of a frame of reference. That of course you work out these deals in secret. You don't want the rest of people to know. So you want it to be secret. So there's that kind of a mindset about negotiating and about working things out in regard to your industry or your business that lends itself to the idea, well, of course it should be secret.
But there are other times that and people have come to realize this, that too much secrecy, like, you know, there are laws against price fixing.
And those are the when those individuals get together and they say, okay, well, it's 7% and we're not going to cheat each other. We've got to be on par here, right, guys? We're back in that situation, are we?
We are.
And so that's price fixing legal.
Yeah, the thing is that sometimes there are whistleblowers.
Simple, huh? Oh, yeah.
And that information gets out, and then some kind of action is finally taken. And so with the laws in place in that kind of arena, there is at least the possibility that you're going to be able to do something about it. But you're right. It's a similar kind of situation. It is. It's a very similar kind of situation that the goal tends to be to maximize your own gain. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that better in secrecy, well, of course, you go for secrecy.
What happens.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What areas, the pharmacy, the patent laws, et cetera, can you kind of go into that and explain those other areas?
It's hard to know where to start.
Well, one of the things, question.
Yeah, one of the things that I do think about in the stuff that I've been reading in regard to the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that the pharmaceutical industry and intellectual property in general, the stuff that you would want to copyright on or the stuff that you would want to patent on, that they have been pushing extremely hard. And some of the material that I've read suggests to me that the fact that we are doing that is one of the reasons why this agreement has not been finished, is that there are other parts of the world, other nations involved around the ring, you know, Canada or around to Japan, that don't want that, that they think that that's going to be bad for them. So, for example, one of the things that have been pointed to is that it may be that it will change the availability of drugs related to HIV stuff. And so they don't want to let that happen, that international property gets so much more control. They've been wanting to extend the life of a patent, and they did it, as I understand, they did it for 3 or 4 years, several years back. But they won't extend it beyond that. It's either in some place... wild guesses that some of them would like to make it another 17 years and so forth. And I've also heard that some people talking about copyrights, which I think has been in the ballpark of 52 years. They want to extend it for a couple of hundred or whatever. The way that that's going to impact us is that if they get the ability to control generics more than they have been able to control them, if they get to extend their patents, it simply means that they're going to get a lot more money than they would have gotten if that change had not been made. So it's sort of like what this does is decide who's going to prosper here, who's going to get the money, and who's going to be paying the money. And if they get the extension of the patents, well, the money's going to flow to the corporations that have got the patent or the copyright, whichever one. That's where the money's going to go. And that means then that you and I have less money to do this, that, and the other thing. And as always, the poor are hurt again the hardest because they are the ones that most desperately need to have cheap medicine and stuff like that because they just don't have the moolah to be able to afford it. You hear these pieces that are done by investigative reporters about some family that's getting along, not wonderfully well, but they're getting along, bang, somebody gets sick, and the whole thing falls apart. The car is gone, the house is gone. And there you go. So it is important for the generics to be able to be producing those products so that the people, after a corporation has made a chunk of money on it, why, it seems like there ought to be someone. And a lot of people argue that an awful lot of the work that makes those patents possible has been done under federal grants. And it may have been that the federal grants went to universities or wherever that did the research, but that's the basic stuff then that is used by industry to create a product. They can then go ahead and do something about creating this product or that product or another product. And so it is like, well, after a while, boys, haven't you gotten, you know, what's fair? How about getting this back to where more of the money stays with the lower-income people or whatever? So those are some of the ways that it can hit all of us because the fact that reducing the cost of medications is so important for senior citizens is one of the reasons why... George Bush and his group put in the place this Part D of the medicine-related stuff in healthcare has been helpful And here I know of a few people that have said to me they got into the donut hole, which is the place where you pay full freight for $3,000 or whatever it is. And that's because of the cost of medicine. So the more that medicines move from being still patented to being generic, the more those people are going to benefit. And having that as work of the government to try to move stuff in that direction, I think has been very beneficial. This stuff seems to be working contrary to that, in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Because I know one of the plans, the advantage, the Coventry advantage, that any generic that you want on this particular plan is free.
Oh, my.
As long as you ordered it through the mail and you got 3 to 6 months supply.
Oh, that's great.
But it's free.
Mm-hmm.
But if we have no generics left.
Those things have a way of multiplying. It's sort of like one of the reasons why we're having concerns, financial concerns that we are generally as a nation, is because all of these people are out of work. And so they're not paying taxes. They don't have any income to pay the taxes on. And so that has then all kinds of ramifications for supporting education, supporting libraries, supporting the arts, supporting new developments in research that could be used by manufacturers, new products, and all that kind of stuff. So when you damage it, it's a big consequence. And one of the things that I think is relevant to this is because we've had these trade agreements for some time now, and they have, in my opinion, not created the outflow of jobs and the outflow of industry, but facilitated it. Because there was some going on before there were these trade agreements, but it's made it easy for them to do that, and it made it attractive for them to do that, is to ship so much stuff being done overseas. And I think about what you read about occasionally is rural communities that are just sort of dying, that once had an industry there, and it made all the difference in the world. Almost everybody, well, let's say half of the population, had jobs in that industry, and things were moving along. Halfway decent, maybe not rich consequences, but they could pay their bills and they could live a decent life and send their kids to college even. And when you put into place something that's going to drive down wages, you're running up against that whole thing. You're in the process almost of destroying rural communities.
You're listening to an interview by Linda Neville of MoveOn.org with Frank Neff discussing the multinational secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Well, but my agenda, even reading an article in the paper this morning, it's like an average of, within our own central area, it's Kansas, Missouri, and the surrounding states, that our rural populations are already distressed, and over 25%, cannot afford any health care at all, which, of course, is another issue. But this directly has an impact, as you were saying, on
right.
that as well.
Yeah.
So it's a frightening thing.
Yeah, well, you know, you think about it and realize that what this means is that manufacturers, the top management and their stockholders are going to continue to get reasonably decent or maybe really big payments or dividends.
Absolutely.
And that means that that money is funneled into a small number of people, whereas before
1%.
It was spread around to a lot of other people. Now it's being funneled in. And so you've got the problem of the people that have lost their jobs or who get their wages cut tremendously, not being able to pay for health care, not being able to pay for a new automobile, not being able to pay for repairs of their house. I mean, it's got all those kinds of ramifications. So these trade agreements really are very big deals. And one of the problems is that somehow the past way of thinking about trade agreements was, well, of course, that's what business has to negotiate and so forth. And it's not something that we should have a lot of influence over. That way you think about it, it's just not going to work because the tendency is to do that which makes what your goal is happen. And the people that are hurt by that are outside. Yeah, they're outside the situation.
Where do we go from here? What can we do? Do we need to be calling our congressional people? And what do we say?
Well,
that's a toughie.
I think definitely we should be calling them. I think that our three members of Congress are probably pretty much on the side of the business people that want the agreement to be finalized. But I think they need to know that there are a number of people. And so I think the more people that call and write and try to get into their office and talk to them, the more of those that we can get, the better off we're going to be. and writing letters to the editor, putting the stuff in the paper, and there are times when I think outdoor protesting is helpful. Unfortunately, the time that's best for really making a difference is early on. You and I are late in the game,
well,
but there are organizations that have been at it for a long time. The Public Citizen, which is the organization for consumers, concerned about consumers, that got started with Ralph Nader way back when and has been growing and continuing to expand and move into a lot of different areas. They have had since in the early 1990s a group called the Global Trade Watch, which is headed up by a woman lawyer by the name of Lori Wallach. And she is crackerjack. She's great stuff. Well, anyway, so they've been working on this issue since before NAFTA got finalized and have been working all the time since then. In the middle 1990s, I went to Washington a couple times to conferences that they were sponsoring in regard to the trade agreement stuff and what can be done about it and how to go to work on it and so forth. And so they're still hard at it, and they are in the central part of this battle. I get multiple emails a day from the people that are working with this group. They've got an interorganizational group called the Citizens Trade Campaign, and that has brought in people from religious groups and commercial groups, from labor unions, from all arenas, to participate in this effort to make trade agreements be productive for the citizenry. And so they are doing everything they can to advertise to people that this is the stuff that's going on and what the history of this has been from NAFTA up to the present. And you may remember the one called CAFTA, Central American Free Trade Agreement, and there are a lot of them that are bilateral, like with Colombia, and there is one with Chile, and there is one with Panama and a number of other countries in this area, and then also for other parts of the world. Singapore, for example, is a nation that we have a trade agreement with. So there are a lot of these trade agreements, and trying to stop them, trying to get people to understand, has been what the Citizens Trade Campaign has been pushing. And they encourage getting people to get out and vote for, and to encourage candidates that understand this and will vote that way if they get elected, trying to help with the election of them. So I think all those things are important. So one of the things that I think people with a sort of long-range view have is we need to get more Democrats into the Congress. We need to also, interestingly enough, we need to get more Democrats into local offices, because you can say, I ought to go up to this step. I'm already at this step. I know something about this job. If I've been a member of the school board, if I've been a member of the city council, why, I can go to Topeka and I can be in the state legislature up there. Up there, while I've been in this legislative business, I know how it's done. I should go to Washington, because that's where many of these important things are done. We've got to get more people in those kinds of offices. But immediately, what you said is, I think we should do everything we can to persuade Congress to vote against the fast track and to not let that get put into place. That would probably be very damaging to Obama and his reputation, and I think that's unfortunate, but I think that that's, I mean,
the
he's on the wrong side of the fence with this thing. So that, I think, is the key thing, is to contact our congressman. But I think that, in a way, more fundamentally, we need to talk to our friends and neighbors and say, look at this. Look at what's going on. We've got to do something about this. We can't not do it. We've got to recognize that being a citizen in a democracy is a lot more demanding than going to the polls and voting every 4 years or every 2 years. You've got to do things that are going to impact the people who go in. You've got to have people going into those offices who are sympathetic to the things that you're concerned about. And make the point, you don't object to trade. The idea of trade, when it's beneficial all the way around, is great. And so we should support trade. We are not opposed to trade. We are opposed to these kinds of agreements that result in funneling the money in directions that are not helpful to the people, taking jobs away from people so that somebody else can make a pile of money. It is not going to enable us to go where we need to go to have these agreements piling up on it. And since this one is big, and since this one is extensive, and since this one looks like it's very bad from what we know about it, we need to stop it. the fact that we know so little about it is also a bad,
it's overwhelming,
bad condition. Because in a sense, we're talking about rumors and innuendo and WikiLeaks, and so we don't really know what's in that agreement.
Okay, so listeners, get out there, pick up the phone and start writing some letters and make your voice heard. And more importantly, because unfortunately we have become a society that we just aren't active anymore and we're not discussing these issues, get out and talk to your friends, your family, and your neighbors. It may be difficult, but it's something that's got to get done. It's got to be done immediately. We only have, as far as Fast Track is concerned, a couple of weeks. Get the information out. Come on, WikiLeaks. Okay, Frank, thank you so much. For more information, like us on Facebook at JOCO, that's J-O-C-O, Move On. This has been Linda Neville, MoveOn.org. Thanks for joining us.
Join us in 2 weeks for the next edition of Radioactive Magazine when Craig LeBeau tells us about the Innocence Project. That's Thursday, January 16th at 7 p.m. You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.